From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actress Charlotte Rampling. She's starring in the new movie Swimming Pool. 2 years ago, she made a comeback following a long depression with the film Under the Sand. She'll tell us why she gravitates to dark roles. Also, Seabiscuit opens today, the film about the racehorse who came out of obscurity to become a beloved champion. We'll have a review by film critic David Edelstein and hear from actors Chris Cooper and Jeff Bridges, who star in it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At a White House news conference with President Bush, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas said that Israel needs to do more to meet its obligations under a new U.S.-backed peace initiative. Abbas is the first Palestinian leader to be invited to the Bush White House. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Israel and the Palestinians both have taken some steps under the roadmap, which is designed to lead to a Palestinian state. But Abbas says the Palestinians have done more. He's demanding greater momentum in areas such as halting Israeli settlement activity and the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Palestinian areas. President Bush was sympathetic on some issues, but he warned that all terrorist activity will have to stop in order to resolve the major problems between Israel and the Palestinians.
Nobody is going to accept a situation in which they become less secure.
The roadmap requires the Palestinian Authority to dismantle and disarm militant groups. So far, Abbas has refused. He says that trying to use force against the militants would result in civil war. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush has ordered U.S. troops to take up positions off the coast of Liberia. West African foreign ministers have said regional forces will be sent to Liberia next week, and White House spokesman Scott McClellan says the American troops will help support those peacekeepers.
We are doing everything we can right now to enable the West Africans to get in there, and that's why we're positioning our military capabilities.
Pentagon officials say three troop-carrying ships have been ordered to head for Liberia, but it will take them several days to get there. In an effort to convince skeptical Iraqis that Saddam Hussein's sons are dead, the U.S. Army had military morticians clean up the bodies and then put them on display for reporters. Despite the elimination of the sons, NPR's Ivan Watson says attacks on U.S. troops continued today.
On the same day that the video of the two corpses was released, there was another explosion here in the heart of the Iraqi capital, just less than a mile from here. An explosion went off in an intersection of this posh neighborhood. An American Humvee was damaged. At least one Iraqi was seriously injured. And Iraqi eyewitnesses say they saw at least one American soldier taken away wounded, though American soldiers on the scene said nobody had been hurt in the blast. So resistance, this guerrilla insurgency that's been underway for the past 2.5 months, has not stopped the announcement of the deaths of Saddam Hussein's two sons.
NPR's Ivan Watson reporting from Baghdad. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 172 points, or nearly 2%, to close at 9,284. The NASDAQ gained 29 to close at 1730. This is NPR News. Filmmaker John Schlesinger has died in Palm Springs, California. The British-born Schlesinger directed one of America's all-time classic films, Midnight Cowboy. Schlesinger was 77. He'd suffered a stroke 3 years ago. NPR's Renee Montaigne has this report.
John Schlesinger made his name with British films that were among the first to capture the sensibility of the 1960s youth generation. Billy Lyer is told from the point of view of a working-class adolescent who daydreams of a swinging life in London. Darling tells of a coldly ambitious young model. Schlesinger's affinity for dubious heroes brought him unexpected commercial success and an Oscar with the 1969 film Midnight Cowboy. With the greasy Ratso Rizzo, played by Dustin Hoffman, and the naive Texas hustler, played by John Voight, the director offered characters who were both shocking and touching. John Schlesinger has said he was more interested in the failures of the world than the successes because, quote, it's important to get people to care a little for someone else. I'm Renee Montaigne, NPR News, Los Angeles.
A state medical investigator in New Mexico says an autopsy has confirmed that President Bush's nominee to be Secretary of the Navy committed suicide yesterday. The autopsy report says Colin McMillan died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. McMillan's body was found yesterday by workers at his ranch in southern New Mexico. Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico said McMillan had a recurrence of cancer, but was believed to be recuperating quite well. McMillan, who is 67, was the chairman of Permian Exploration, an oil and gas company. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own, whose line of all-natural foods includes salad dressing, salsa, and lemonade. Paul Newman donates all after-tax profits to charity.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Charlotte Rampling was a major international star when she was young, and a daring one. Her movie roles in the 1960s and 70s range from mainstream comedies and dramas, like Georgie Girl and The Verdict, to Woody Allen's dark Stardust Memories, and even darker movies, like The Damned and The Night Porter. Yet after that run of bold films and performances, Rampling spun into a long bout of depression that prevented her from acting for many years. In 2001, she made a major comeback, starring in Under the Sand, a French film directed by François Ozon. Ozon has just made his first English-language film, called Swimming Pool. And once again, Rampling is the star. She plays Sarah Morton, a mystery novelist whose editor tries to snap her out of a writer's block by sending her to his vacation home in the south of France.
I don't give a damn about money or success. I just want to find...
an inspiring plot.
No, you don't understand. It's got nothing to do with inspiration. I'm fed up with murders and investigations.
Do you like France?
I like frog's legs. So what?
My house. Why don't you go there for a while? Breathe some fresh air. It's free, it's out of season, the weather's glorious, there's a swimming pool.
Would you come and visit me?
Well, I have got my daughter. But maybe I'll come for a weekend.
Rolling Stone film critic Peter Travers wrote that Rampling's performance in Swimming Pool adds nuance, not to mention a nude scene that shows off a body Demi Moore would envy. Terry spoke with Charlotte Rampling in 2001 after the release of Under the Sand.
You were born in England in 1946. Your father was a British colonel who became a NATO commander. What did he do in World War II?
He was a gunner in the Royal Artillery, and he was posted to Malta.
So you grew up just after the war in England. Did you have vivid memories about the war through what your parents told you?
No, because my father never spoke of it. And it was very true about a lot of people who had been through the war. People didn't speak about things like that in those days. So I never knew. I never knew anything about anything that my father had done because he wouldn't tell me. And I still don't.
You must feel like there's a whole part of him that you don't know.
There is, and he, you never know, because it might just all come out and just before he dies. When I say all come out, that's, you know, in a way that's rather a romantic illusion, but he is beginning to talk now. Since my mother died, he's beginning to talk, which is really quite extraordinary. So you never know. You never know until somebody dies what they will reveal.
I don't know if your father talked to you about this, but he won a gold medal in the 400-meter relay in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. This was the Olympics that was documented in the Leni Riefenstahl movie Triumph of the Will. Could you see him in the film?
Yes, oh yes. I mean, I only knew about that through somebody else who told me that they'd seen my father in a film and that he'd won this medal. I mean, that's as much as he's, you know, boxed into his isolation. And so then I found out and I said, Dad, I'm sending you a film that you're in. And then we started to break down. He started to break into it and I tried to talk about it a bit and he talked about it a bit. But it's the most beautiful film, and he runs like a guard because he had to catch up a race that the runner before him was losing because he was ill, Frank Wolf. My father was in the second lap of the relay, and it's an extraordinary race. And the BBC recorded it too as one of the most outstanding athletical feats, and he won a record for that race. He held a record for many, many years for running, absolutely. And then after that, I think he stopped because he ran so well that I think he couldn't bear it and he had to stop. They're strange people, the men of those years.
Did you have a strict upbringing? Was he strict with you?
Yeah, but although I resented it, I'm quite glad I did have a strict upbringing. I like that.
Were you told before you started acting that you were beautiful? And did that make your life any better, any easier? Were there any surprising complications from that?
No, because I don't think you really sort of do know that you're beautiful in a funny way. I know this sounds odd again, but if you ask any young, beautiful woman, they sort of, you just want to be part of the pack, actually, at that age. You just want to learn how to grow up and not be taken out and sort of be shown that you're too different. I mean, that's how I felt.
But usually, you know, the assumption is being really attractive increases your stature, makes you more liked, more popular.
Yeah, it does.
More everything that young girls want to be.
Yes, but I knew that I didn't deserve it, and it wasn't anything to do with me. So I knew from a very early age that I should never play with this as some kind of weapon because it didn't belong to me. And it was useful. It could be useful. And it sure has been useful. And I've had fantastic years knowing that I'm beautiful. But I was also terrified about the whole, why did people like me more than my friend who was less beautiful? Why did I get the advantages? Why was always I asked out to parties and they weren't?
Were there things you really wanted to be noticed for that you felt you had more earned, that were more about your talents or your personality?
Well, you think so, but you don't quite know at that age. You think, you know, there must be other, you know, there are other things, deeper, deeper hidden things that you want to learn about as you grow older and as you grow up. Deep things that you feel that are your value, your own personal unique value, that only belong to you as a unique individual. Being part of a collective, but just almost on your own, and beauty is something that gives you pathways into all these fields if you want to. But I've always felt I've really beaten myself up about it in a sense that I felt that I really had to earn it. That's all. And but then if I'd been ugly, it would have been the same thing. I'd have fought as hard to be accepted, and just because I'm not good looking, you know what I mean?
Yes,
it's the right. Battle is the same.
All right.
The battle actually is the same, but the supposedly the beautiful ones have the luckier, you know, have the luckier coin.
So you started making films when you were 17. Mm. You were 20 when your older sister died of a brain aneurysm. So you already had several films that you made. So just as you were, you know, becoming a star and entering into this exciting world, your sister died, and so you were in this kind of increasingly glamorous world at the same time you lost her. There must have been, well, just an incredible contrast between the world you were entering and the grief that you were feeling.
Yeah, and that's when I stopped making fun pictures. I was having a lot of fun. I was really having fun for 3 years, sort of my life. I really had fun. I mean, I'm not saying that I didn't, you know, haven't had later on, but much later on. And the guilt was just terrifying, you know, when somebody dies, and especially with my mother almost, you know, beside herself with grief. You just say, I can't make fun films anymore. So that's when I went into the darker side and did, you know, films. I sought out films that psychologically were much more painful.
Well, let me get to one that's probably about as dark as it gets. This is a film you're very famous for, the 1974 movie The Night Porter. Mm. And you play a concentration camp victim who, several years after the war, you meet up with a Nazi who abused you in the camp, and you both start up a very disturbing kind of sadomasochistic sexual relationship. The Nazi is played by Dirk Bogarde, who you also work with in 1969 in The Damned. How did you feel about taking this role? I mean, this is a role that some people would describe as very dark. Other people might describe it as disturbing. Others might call it kind of sick. You know, it's a pretty
it's
heavy
about,
role.
Yeah, it's about forbidden things, you know. Mm-hmm. and it's about areas that we don't often really want to go into and analyze and think about and turn over and look at. It's about, you know, it's about the deep, dark fantasy world that, you know, perhaps we dream about, but we don't really want to admit it. And I think the reason I took this film, I've lived on a very instinctual level, and my choices are sort of just, you know, grabbed somewhere inside. Because if you start to analyse why you would do Night Porter, and I just had a baby who was my first son, who was 3 months old. And when Dirk Bogarde called me, because I'd worked with him in The Damned of Visconti before, and when he called me, he said, look, I've decided to do this film after 5 years, because I turned it down 3 times. I've decided to do this film. There's only one girl that can do it, and I won't do it with anyone else but you. They wanted Romy Schneider at the time, who was a bit much bigger star. I wasn't a star at all at that time, so I didn't, you know, didn't wield any money or power or name. But when Liliana Cavani saw me with Dirk, she said that was it, and there was a kind of fascinating thing that happened with Dirk and I around this subject. Dirk, for his reasons from the war and the pain and the horrors that he'd lived through the war, and me for what I'd been through on a personal basis. And so, you know, again, that was what we put into the film.
What did you think of as your character's motivation for entering into this relationship with an unreformed Nazi?
Well, she was abused and couldn't do anything else like abused children. She was very young. She was 16. And when she saw him again, it was the only thing that she'd ever really, had really ever deeply affected her, whether it was love, whatever it was such an, it was so affecting to her, this experience that she had when she was 16 in the camp, that when she saw him again, she could not resist it and had to go plunging back into that darkness.
Our guest is Charlotte Rampling. Her new film is called Swimming Pool. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with actress Charlotte Rampling. She's starring in the new film Swimming Pool. When we left off, she was talking with Terry about her controversial role in The Night Porter.
There's a very provocative scene in The Night Porter in which you're singing a very sultry cabaret kind of song in a room of Nazis. You're moving around the room slowly and evocatively, wearing baggy pants which are held up by suspenders, and the suspenders are the only garment that you're wearing from the waist up. Mm. Would you describe filming this scene?
Well, strangely, as films are, this film, that scene was the first scene I had to make in the film. And I arrived, and I not only had to learn the song, the German song of Marlene Dietrich, an old song of hers, but we also had to, you know, learn what we were going to do in this very sort of evocative, tragic scene. And it was the first thing we did. And you just do it. Leben, liebe ich zu leben. Ich kann nur sagen, ich liebe zu gefallen. Wenn auch nicht immer, liebe ich zu lieben. Ich weiß nicht, was ich will und dort erwarte viel.
That's Charlotte Rampling in singing in a scene from the 1974 film The Night Porter. So what was the experience like of making a film that's this dark and this sexually dark? I mean, was it a disturbing experience for you to make the movie?
Yeah. But yeah, completely disturbing. Completely disturbing. But you sort of put yourself on hold, you know. There's a odd technique that you have in this business is you put yourself sort of slightly in denial about a lot of stuff, because otherwise you can't really do it.
Right.
And you know that you can command your body into action to do it absolutely as you want to do it, but your mind is not quite connected to what you're doing. Your mind is somewhere else.
Had you sung much before this movie?
No, just like everybody, you know, singing away. And you do in voice classes, too, that I'd taken, and there was singing, you know, singing lessons and how to project your voice. So I had worked on it, but the voice had to be very bad, really. It had to be not too good. It had to be the terrified, sort of strange voice of a 16-year-old singing under duress. And also, in a way, getting sort of a bit high on it. So there was all that mixed in.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I had read that you had considered singing when you were in your teens, but your father didn't want you to be a singer because it meant wearing short skirts at cabarets. I laughed so hard when I saw that because this is your singing debut here.
Yeah, that's very interesting you bring this up. I just hadn't thought about it. Absolutely true.
It's like his nightmare come true. He was worried about you wearing a short skirt, and here you are, like, you know, wearing nothing but suspenders and pants.
Right. A more decadent debut could you have? Not.
Precisely. Did he ever see the movie?
Well, he said he'd never seen it, but I found out that he had, but years and years and years later. And I wonder, actually, if he really had. Anyway. But we don't talk about my films at home. Well, my mum doesn't, because she can't, but my dad never talks about my work.
It's
one of the subjects that we don't talk about.
Right, I got it.
But he's talking, as I say, he's coming, you know, coming out now a little bit, and he's really beginning. I mean, he was interested why I went to America and what is this film, you know, Under the Sand, first time we've ever actually talked about it. And this is since my mother died, interestingly. It's quite strange things unlock, don't they? You never know. And so he's now talking a little bit about them, and he's realizing a little bit what I've done in my life, and he's saying how proud he is of me and things like that. So it's really moving.
You know how you were saying after your sister died, you really wanted to take roles that weren't like funny and entertaining, but roles that were in dark films because that was the mood that you were in. Did you at some point move away from that and feel that you could do entertaining or funny films again? They didn't have to just be about darkness.
Well, that came later. You see, that came, I would say, in my late 30s, really, when I decided not to make any films at all, because it just wasn't, I mean, I just, all this wanting to go into the darkness through films had been extraordinary, and I'd learned a lot, but I'd come to a dead end. And I then sort of had to go into my own particular world. And then when I came out of that, I suppose that you can call that the depressive time, right? So when I come out of that a few years later, then there was much more fluidity and choice. And yeah, and now films can, they can, I don't know where they'll lead me, but I'm much freer to be able to choose now. I have that choice.
Are you saying you went through a period of depression where you didn't even want to work?
Yeah, but that was very necessary too, obviously, on the kind of journey I was on. If you look in retrospect, I just had to go, you know, had to go into that too, and just shut down, and then you know, and then you learn other things which bring you out, and on you carry on.
How long was that shutting down period?
Well, it wasn't a complete shutdown all the time, but a complete shutdown for about 3 years, and then it sort of eased and eased and eased, and then you realise that you're coming into the light and you're able to actually begin doing things and connecting with the world and all that. And then it becomes, you realise that you're on, you know, you're coming back into yourself, really, because you just completely lose yourself. It's really like dying, I suppose, in a way.
Was this in the 80s and the 90s?
This was in the 90s, yeah.
So one last question. When you were going through your depression, were you confident that you'd come out of it and that you'd eventually work again?
No.
Right. It sounds like it went on for a
few
years.
But you know, you have two options, don't you? To somehow come through it or to take your life. You have two options, and that's why depression is a very serious thing, because you do have the option. A lot of people take the other option. I didn't. You know, there'd been enough death in my family. But I didn't know whether I'd come through, because it just, you know, you have no idea.
Right.
But I think most people do when I don't know the sort of the numbers of it, but you do somehow. I don't know how, and there's all sorts of different ways, but you do come through. But it takes an awful long time. Not all, I mean, there are various degrees, you know. There are various degrees. There are various intensities, too. Some people are much milder than others. You know, thank goodness.
You know, people always wonder, what if you're talented, if you're a movie star and you're beautiful and you have money, how could you be so depressed, right? Like, why, when you have so many gifts? I think some people find that incomprehensible. But it seems it's just kind of beyond all that. It's something more internal than that.
Yeah, because you see, it's about your soul. It's about your spirit. And your spirit doesn't know about all that. And your soul doesn't know about advantages in this world, the wonderful advantages that I have been given, the beauty of, you know, and children and a career and all that. Your spirit and your soul doesn't know about that, and that's what we're talking about. Your spirit is yearning so, so deeply and is in such pain and you don't know why, and that's what you somehow... It's not having to find out, but you just have to nurture it and just to hope that, you know, you will come back wanting to live again.
Well, it's great to see you in movies again, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
That was very nice. Thank you. Thank you for talking to me.
Charlotte Rampling, speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. Rampling stars in the new film Swimming Pool. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Happiest Baby on the Block, The New Way to Calm Crying and Help Your Newborn Baby Sleep Longer by Harvey Karp, M.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Actors Chris Cooper and Jeff Bridges both star in the new film Seabiscuit, based on the best-selling book. Coming up, we feature archive interviews with them. And David Edelstein reviews Seabiscuit, which opens today.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. In a summer when fantasy movies and sequels have dominated the theaters, but not necessarily caught fire at the box office, a movie opens today that's grounded firmly in reality. It's called Seabiscuit, and is the story of the racehorse whose hard luck story, harder luck jockey, and incredible will to persevere against long odds made him the hero of millions during the Depression. By the way, the original movie made about this famous horse, 1949's The Story of Seabiscuit, is shown tonight on the Turner Classic Movies cable network. In the new film Seabiscuit, Chris Cooper plays the role of Seabiscuit's trainer. It's the latest in a winning run for Cooper himself. Before this, he's grabbed rave notices for such offbeat roles as the homophobe in American Beauty and the orchid thief in Adaptation. Terry spoke with Cooper earlier this year, shortly after he won an Oscar for Adaptation.
So the character you're playing, John LaRoche, is the orchid thief. He's somebody who, you know, spends a lot of time in swamps looking for rare orchids. He has a very colorful and mysterious past in which he's done his share of exaggerating and lying, and has been a real loser in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But he's
mm-hmm.
he's obsessive and gifted at the same time. And you know, the Meryl Streep character in the movie is trying to figure out what to make of him.
There was a scene where Susan Orlean and I are driving in the truck at night, and he was becoming a little philosophical about why people spent time around him, and he began to realize that these people that spent time around him were probably very lonely, and that just that did play into Susan Orlean's life at that time. She was thinking over her relationship with her husband. She was not passionate about anything, and that turned out to be a very, very touching, good choice.
Well, let's hear that scene that you just mentioned in the truck with Meryl Streep. And this is my guest, Chris Cooper, with Meryl Streep in a scene from Adaptation.
So I got married, and me and my beautiful new wife, my now ex-wife, the bitch, opened up a nursery. People started coming out of the woodwork to ask me stuff, admire my plants and admire me. I think some people were really spending time with me because they were lonely. And you know why I like plants?
Huh.
Because they're so mutable. Adaptation's a profound process. It means you figure out how to thrive in the world.
No, but it's easier for plants. I mean, they have no memory. You know, they just move on to whatever's next. For the person, adapting is almost shameful. It's like running away.
Now, for your role in Adaptation, you had to do prosthetics for your mouth because the character has missing mm-hmm. teeth, which is a part of his biographical story. Is this the first time you had to do the whole prosthetic thing for a role and go through the hours of fitting it on and gluing it on before each day's shooting?
Yeah, certainly the mouthpiece. And I mean, it was just a very expensive set of Halloween teeth that fit very securely over my teeth, and you did have to make extra space in the mouth cavity to, you know, work around those new set of teeth. But I have, I think I've done three other characters who were burn victims that involve quite a lot of, you know, exterior prosthetic work around the face. But that was the first time I ever had to use the mouthpiece, and it did take some real getting used to. I had several pair a month and a half to work with, and I'd walk around the house with them and just talk with my wife and talk with my son's caregiver and talk with my son, and they just had to put up with it.
But I got very used to it, very, very comfortable.
I know your son has cerebral palsy. Did he get while you were wearing this thing, and why you looked so weird all of a sudden?
Yeah, he does. His best vision is sort of to the side, and I would get these very side looking expressions of "Oh, Dad, you're doing it again," you know? and he'd had little giggles here and there, but he puts up with it. Very normal around the house.
You grew up in Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
and your father was a doctor, and I think the family also had a cattle ranch.
Yes, uh-huh.
That wasn't your home, but you were there summers. So how did that work that there was a cattle ranch that your family owned, but it's not where you lived?
We lived in the city in Kansas City, Missouri, and the cattle ranch was in Kansas City, Kansas, and we had a hired hand who did... looked over the cattle, and he was also a security guard at Leavenworth Prison. So he carried two jobs, and it was during the winter months. In some respects, it's not that difficult. You just need to keep shelter for the cattle, and you need to feed them, and they're pretty much on their own throughout the winter. And then in summertime. There is haying in the spring. There's calving season, and there's a lot of barbed wire fence to put up or repair. So I would spend springs and summers out there, and weekends throughout the year.
Everything I know about cattle, I learned as a child by watching Rawhide, the TV series about the cattle drivers. That gave Clint Eastwood his start. Now, I realize that's about the cattle drive, which is the next step after the cattle ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Did you watch Rawhide when you were a kid?
I watched Rawhide on occasion. I was more of a rifleman.
Oh, that was a great show, too.
Myself.
Yes,
right. Yeah.
But it didn't teach you as much about cattle.
But we had the cattle drive when the mamas are ready to drop their calves. You have to... keep an eye on them, and then 6 months later, when the calves, they call them 6 months heifers, that's when you start to wean them from their mamas, and that's another roundup to separate the cows from the calves. And then at that time, you also do the castrating and the vaccinating and the tattooing, which is a ear identification number for the cattle.
Did you like that work?
I loved it. It was either, at that time, it was either acting or ranching, and they are obviously two extremes, but I just loved the life there, and it was a very pleasant way to live, I thought.
So your father was a doctor, and he owned a cattle ranch. What did he think about you trying to become an actor? Did he prefer that you become, a doctor-lawyer type of professional?
Well, Dad, knowing his own profession, he never pushed my being a doctor. His hours were ungodly, going from hospital rounds in the morning to the office. Then he was one of the last doctors to do house calls. And then he would be called at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning for emergencies. And I saw the toll that it sort of took on my mother's and father's relationship, that they were in love with each other until the day he died. It was not an easy life. He was a very dedicated man. However, when I mentioned that I was interested in being an actor, he really thought that was about the silliest thing a person could do for a living. And then once I started getting work, he did become very, very supportive. And I think he was... had a touch of pride in seeing some of the early work.
Chris Cooper, speaking earlier this year with Terry Gross. He stars in the new film Seabiscuit. We'll hear more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Chris Cooper, who's starring in the new film Seabiscuit.
You didn't start making movies until you were, what, 35, and John Sayles cast you in the lead of Mate One, which is about a coal miner strike in West Virginia.
Right.
Are there things that you learned making your first movie with John Sayles and also doing Lone Star with John Sayles? That's the movie I first really noticed you in, Lone Star. I thought, wow, this is somebody to keep an eye on.
Yeah, well, early on in shooting Mate One, that being the first film, I was over the moon, you know, just being involved for a first film. There could be nothing better than working with James Earl Jones and David Strathairn and some of the other actors. What I did learn was early on to really conserve energy. I was looking over the shoulder of John and Haskell Wexler, the cinematographer, and in scenes that I was not even involved with, just watching other actors work, watching the crew work, the technicians, trying to get an understanding of lights and lenses, every aspect of filmmaking, and I was burning myself out, you know, for the scenes that I had to do. That was so. Truly, that was an outstanding lesson, was to do your work and leave the rest of the work to the other cast and crew and save your energy, because there's a lot more work to come up.
Well, the next big role that you're in is in Seabiscuit, the movie based on the best-selling book about the racehorse. Tell us a little bit about your role in that.
The character is Tom Smith, and he's a bit of a mystery man. There's not very much information about him, but he was one of the last of the cowboys. At the turn of the century, he would rope and break and sell Mustangs for a living. And once the cowboy era came to an end, they were out of work. And so what do they do to make a living? That's when the idea of, what do you call it, those dude ranches, when the dude ranches came into existence, cowboys would work there, or they could work at Wild West shows, and that's indeed what Tom Smith did. Then he moved on to farrier work, that's working, you know, working with horses, and he did a bit of training, horse training at Mexican racetracks. But a man who I think probably felt more comfortable and spent more time with animals than he did human beings.
So, although the Western era on TV and in the movies is over, your cattle ranch experience is actually paying off again.
Again, yeah, sure did.
Well, Chris Cooper, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, very welcome. Thank you, Terry.
Chris Cooper stars in the new film Seabiscuit. He spoke with Terry Gross earlier this year. Jeff Bridges also stars in Seabiscuit. He plays the horse's owner, the man who put his faith in the trainer, the jockey, and the horse itself.
You all are here today because this is a horse who won't give up.
That's right.
Even when life beats him by a nose. But heck, everybody loses a couple.
Yes, sir.
And you either pack up and you go home or you keep fighting. Isn't that right?
That's right.
That's right. Now, do you want to see a match race?
Yeah!
You do?
Yeah!
You want to see this young fella ride that horse?
Jeff Bridges has a long line of movie credits that's as impressive as it is eclectic. It includes starring roles in The Big Lebowski, The Fabulous Baker Boys, and Starman, and a supporting role in the film that put him on the map as a young man, The Last Picture Show. He comes from an acting family. His brother is character actor Beau Bridges. Their father is the late Lloyd Bridges, who starred in the TV show Sea Hunt when the boys were growing up. Terry spoke with Bridges in 1993.
Can we go back to the beginning, talk about your early days?
Sure.
Okay. I have to confess to you that, like, a lot of... I'm about your age. I think I'm a year younger than you are. So, like, a lot of people, I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of people, I grew up watching Sea Hunt, right?
That's right.
I grew up living in an apartment building in Brooklyn, New York, but I knew how to prevent getting the bends.
Very good.
Yeah, like this is going to be real useful information to me.
can you hum the Sea Hunt theme?
Gosh, you know, I don't think I can. Can you? Go ahead.
Something like that. I got to get off there at the end.
No, were your friends, did they watch the show, and did that mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah, sure. They watched the show. A lot of them liked it. You know, occasionally I would get the, you think you're so great, you're Mike Nelson's kid. Yeah, you think you're real great, don't you? You know, I get some of that. But all in all, it was, you know, the kids pretty much dug it, I thought.
You were on some episodes when you were a kid. How old
yeah.
were you, and what were the scenes? What did you have to do?
Oh, I was about, I think on the first one, maybe about 9 years old. I remember being trapped in a cave, and Mike Nelson had to dive under there and get me. And my girlfriend of the time, my neighbor, Andy Kaplan, was playing my partner in that one. And my dad, Mike Nelson, had to swim under there and save us. And I remember telling my girlfriend, I said, well, maybe if we sing, they'll hear us and they'll save us. And I had to sing a song.
Underwater? Oh, this was an underwater cave. This was a regular
cave. It's like, you know, the tide is rising, you know, and trapped us in this cave.
Of course, of course.
I remember being thrown off Malibu Pier in the middle of winter and, you know, having to say my lines with the cold water, you know, that sort of thing.
Whose idea was it for you to do the episodes, yours or your father's?
It was my dad's. You know, he said, there's a little kid part in here, you want to do it? And took me a second, then I realized I could get out of school for the week, and so I said, yeah, I'll do that.
Let me ask you, your brother Beau Bridges was 9 years older than you. Did he ever have to take care of you when you were young, and did you, like, tag along with him and his friends against his will?
Being 8 years older, it was almost a lot of times it was a kind of an uncle, you know, nephew relationship almost.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have the typical kind of competition, really. I looked up to him, and he was always so great in sports. He was scouted by the Dodgers, you know, and he was on the UCLA basketball team. And for a guy who is, I think he's about 5'10 or 11, you know, he was playing out there with Walt Hazard and all those guys. And, you know, he taught me how to do all those sports and box and everything. So he was, I really did look up to him. He really was my hero. And then he taught me how to act, and we would do, we used to do this thing, this idea we came up with, where, you know, so often you talk to actors and they say, you know, it's tough because we need an audience, you know, and there's no audience. You can't just act in your room by yourself. That's not gratifying at all. So what Beau and I would do is we'd rent a flatbed truck, and we would play the supermarket circuit. We would get a few scenes together, and we would go into a supermarket parking lot, and we would get on the back of the flatbed truck, and we would act, and we would get people to all come around and watch our show and improvise and do kind of crazy things until the cops would come, and then we'd try to include the cops in the show, and they would kind of get flustered, and then one of us would get in the driver's seat and drive off to the next supermarket.
So it's kind of a strange thing to do, pull up a flatbed truck to a supermarket parking lot and put on a little show. What did people make of it?
I don't know. You know, sometimes we would start it with a fight. You know, my father taught us how to fake fight, you know, do stage fighting. So sometimes we would start it with a fight, you know, to get people saying, what's happening, to get a crowd around us. And then we would say, we're just kidding. We're going to put on a show. And then they'd gather around. It's a good idea. I recommend it highly for all you actors out there who need an audience.
Jeff Bridges, speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. His father's show, Sea Hunt, is on TV right now on the Outdoor Life Network. Jeff Bridges stars in the new film Seabiscuit. What did our film critic think of the movie? We'll find out after this break. This is Fresh Air. For a time in the 1930s, a scrappy racehorse named Seabiscuit was America's biggest celebrity, ahead of FDR and Clark Gable. 2 years ago, Laura Hillenbrand captured the public's imagination all over again with her best-selling book, Seabiscuit. The new movie, with the same name, is directed by Gary Ross, who wrote Big and Dave and directed Pleasantville. It stars Tobey Maguire, Jeff Bridges, and Chris Cooper. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
A lot of people have been chomping at the bit for the movie of Seabiscuit. Like me, they were thrilled to pieces by Laura Hillenbrand's bestseller about the most celebrated racehorse who ever lived. With its layers of detail that put you deep inside the action, the book had an easy canter that finally became a joyride. It told the story of three disparate and traumatized men who in the 1930s found a common obsession in a horse no one wanted, a small, misshapen animal with a lazy disposition and an unruly temper. With his ferocious drive and his relish for not just winning, but coming from behind in high theatrical style, that horse would also become the obsession of a traumatized nation. The movie, directed and written by Gary Ross, is winning rhapsodic reviews. It looks beautiful. The dirt flies up in lyrical slow motion, and the white light transfigures the jockeys. Randy Newman's music is yearning and plangent. The chords descend, yet the notes reach out for something. My bet is the ineffable. There might as well be a sign under every radiant image that says, "Wasn't that a time?" The camera plunges you into the middle of the races so that even when you can't tell what's happening, you're turned on by the speed and the streaking horse bodies and the thunderous soundtrack. I don't mean to look a gift horse in the mouth. Seabiscuit has some stirring sequences, fine performances, and not incidentally, many excellent hats. But consider the introduction of Chris Cooper as Seabiscuit's ornery trainer, Smith. While the music sighs plaintively, he surveys the prairie, once filled with horses and now defaced by automobiles and chain-link fences. If you think this vision of 19th-century America sadly contemplating the end of the frontier is flat-footed and pseudo-poetic, where Hillenbrand had been precise and evocative, you'll groan the way I did. Or you might be honestly moved. That's what makes horse races. Cooper is playing a man described by Hillenbrand as so taciturn he might be in the early stages of invisibility. And as written and performed, he certainly does recede. But then everything but the races is more pictorial than dramatic. The scene you're going to hear is as intimate as the movie gets. Tobey Maguire is the jockey Red Pollard, who has angered Smith by whacking back at riders who fouled him. Jeff Bridges plays Seabiscuit's owner, a multimillionaire Buick dealer who celebrated the death of the horse before losing a son in an auto accident.
What the hell were you thinking?
He fouled me. What am I supposed to do? Let him get away with that?
Well, yeah, when he's 40-1.
He almost put me in the rail.
Well, did he? Look, we had a plan.
He fouled me, Tom. What am I supposed to do? He cut me off. He fouled me!
Son, what are you so mad at?
Bridges played a cockeyed optimist car magnate in Tucker, and this performance is an older, deeper version, with notes of melancholy that anchor the movie. But the eye-opening turn is by McGuire. True, he's not the first actor to leap to mind as a wiry, hot-headed jockey. But once I got past the absence of the actor's most distinctive trait, that slightly morbid shyness, I began to see how impressive he was. McGuire has dieted himself down to bone and sinew so that his eyes pop out, shining and hungry. There is, however, a major absent character, Seabiscuit. I have a friend, a horse nut, who felt let down by the book because he wanted to read about a horse and not people. He might as well skip the movie, in which Seabiscuit is played by 10 different anonymous animals. Once in a while, there's a close-up of his eye to show you, I guess, that he's not blind. But the charged relationship among horse, trainer, and jockey is alluded to by a narrator without really being dramatized. In The Black Stallion, the director Carol Ballard proved you could photograph a horse to make every ripple of his physique seem expressive without ever anthropomorphizing him. But you look at Seabiscuit and think, oh, a horse. The movie does catch you up in the climactic race, and it has a final shot I won't spoil that suspends the action at just the right mythic instant. But the best thing about Seabiscuit is that it will make a lot of people hungry to read the book. They've seen the pretty pictures. Now they'll want to enter the world.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillock. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of the 1953 CIA coup in Iran. We talk with New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. Join us for the next Fresh Air.